This show is a Hopful Media podcast production.
Hey, History of Persia fans. Before Persia, another civilization controlled the Middle East. The very first civilization, the inventors of writing itself. From the clay tablets of ancient Mesopotamia come the oldest stories. The history and myth of the first Mesopotamians is the subject of the Oldest Stories podcast online at oldeststories.net. If you like ancient history, come check out the Oldest Stories after you listen to this episode.
The history of Persia is intertwined with conquest. It began with conquest when Cyrus, king of a small city called Anshan, set out to build the greatest empire the world had ever seen. In a series of stunning campaigns, he achieved just that, becoming one of the greatest conquerors in history, and basically started Persian history. After all, you don't get the title the Great for nothing. But he wouldn't be the last great Persian conqueror. Other Persian rulers like Darius the Great, Mithridates I, and Ardashir I would go on to become great conquerors on their own, establishing their own great empires and legacies. If you want to hear their story, and the stories of other great conquerors, many of whom are far less famous despite their great achievements, join me, Ramzi Shalah, on my podcast, The Conquerors Podcast, available on all platforms you listen through.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to a History of Persia live episode. As I have mentioned the last several times you've heard from me, I will be presenting at this year's Intelligent Speech Conference. If you are hearing this when it comes out, Intelligent Speech is just a couple days away on Saturday, February 8th. We've got a ton of indie podcasters presenting on a wide range of both historical and ahistorical topics. Hypothetically, every single one of them is supposed to end in a live question and answer session. This year's theme is deception. So we've got Otto English, the author of books like Fake Heroes and Fake History, the Fake History Hunter podcast, and Wesley Livesey from History of the Great War and History of the Second World War. We also have panel presentations with names like Byzantine Deception, Computer History, and The Cake is a Lie. I will personally be appearing in four time slots. I am on the religion panel to talk about early modern Zoroastrianism. I will be on the pen names panel to talk about ancient anonymous authors, and I will be playing Call My Bluff, a sort of historical two truths and a lie. I will also be giving a full presentation on Darius the Great and the Behistun inscription. Of course, I will do my level best to leave time for questions at the end of each of them. The whole event will be available for rewatch for a whole week after it ends. If you buy your tickets now, you are running out of time. Go to intelligentspeechonline.com to get yours and tune in this Saturday. Once again, that is February 8th at 10 a.m. U.S. Eastern Time, and you can get those tickets at intelligentspeechonline.com. If that isn't enough to get you interested, today's episode is actually the audio recording from last year's Ancient Persia panel, and it is directly relevant to our current podcast narrative, significantly more than it was last year. I sat down with Umberto from So You Think You Can Rule Persia and Derek from the Hellenistic Age podcast to discuss the weird little Iranian kingdoms that popped up throughout the Hellenistic period. One last time, intelligentspeechonline.com, this Saturday, February 8th at 10 a.m. U.S. Eastern Time. Buy your tickets, watch it live or stream it later, but if you come on the day of, I will do multiple Q&As, as will many of the other presenters. I hope we see you then.
Hello, if you are in the audience. My name is Bree. I am the host of Pontifex, but I am not here to do that because I am your administrator for this wonderful panel on ancient Persia. With all of that out of the way, I'd love to introduce our wonderful panelists. We have Derek, we have Trevor, and we have Umberto. So guys, Persian history, huh?
Oh boy, we have a lot to say.
There is a lot of it.
There's a lot. Yeah, that's true. I mean, should we maybe clarify what we mean by ancient Persia versus not ancient Persia?
Sounds like a good start. Yeah. So yeah, I guess I think what all of our podcasts assume is ancient Persia is basically pre-Islamic Persia. So anything before 651 AD or thereabouts counts as ancient Persia, because then there is pretty significant change in the middle there, which causes history to become a lot more different. And yeah, it sort of is a way to detach ourselves from later on, so we have a more clear area to look into.
And as well, I mean, Persia itself, it's not one continuous existence. There are several dynasties or major powers that dominate at any one time. Generally speaking, that's in the period that we're referring to, that's the Achaemenids, briefly the Macedonian, then became the Seleucid Empire, the Parthians, and then finally the Sassanids as the last non-Islamic power to rule over the Iranian heartland. But today we're going to be focusing mainly on the Hellenistic portion, the Seleucid era to the Parthian era. And our lectures and our talk is focused on Cyrus's shadow, the reception of the Persian Empire in the Hellenistic period. So I guess we can start to talk about, you know, what was exactly, you know, how did Cyrus, or I guess the Persians, viewed after the Alexandrian conquests that took place? That's roughly the from 334 till about 324 BC. And then after that is the Hellenistic Age, lasting down to 30 BC when Cleopatra had committed suicide and whatnot. Do we have any ambitious points before we want to get out? Because I know there's many factions as part of the Hellenistic world. I can name about 20 of them, but I don't want to dominate too much just in case.
One thing I think just to maybe give us a starting point is that as I was preparing my notes for this session, it was occurring to me that it's really the shadow of Artaxerxes II that we're talking about here, because so many of these kingdoms, their big Achaemenid connection and the thing they hearken back to over and over again is that they're all descended from Artaxerxes II, which is in part purely because he had like 111 sons, if I remember correctly, and then approximately as many daughters. So there's a lot of different roads back to him, but he does seem to be kind of at the core of at least Armenia and the kingdoms that spin off of it.
Yeah. I mean, also the Parthians descend theoretically from Artaxerxes II, but I always thought it was a weird point to aim for in your descendants. Like, Artaxerxes II was not the best king. We had much better. You could just as legitimately say you're descended from Darius the Great or Cyrus. Just, you know, the bloodline's there. I always thought it was weird how they just all pointed to Artaxerxes II and said, yeah, that guy, that's who we're all descended from. We're going to follow his example.
And a few of them I noticed as well. It was, you know, a lot of them point back to, I think, Armenia and even, I think, Cappadocia. They pointed to like being one of their family, their progenitor, their ancestor was tied to the seven that assisted Darius in taking the throne from the pretender Bardia. So clearly there is something to it where they just, either if they're not connected, they want to be peripherally connected. And that's how they hearken back to that legitimacy factor.
Yeah. It's also interesting that you mentioned the fact that the seven, because a lot of these quote unquote successor states do tend to just arbitrarily say, no, we have seven important noble families because we're all descended from that tradition there. And yeah, for example, the Parthians, I know, have a ton of that. And then you know, everybody starts to also name their children weird Achaemenid names. Like, you know, I think Mithridates of Pontus has like a Xerxes and a Darius in his family, and it's just spreading it out to make sure that everybody knows who you are exactly and why you're in charge.
Yeah, I think that's a good way to kind of get us into specifics with, you know, either of the two really big ones outside of Parthia, because it becomes its own whole empire forever. But Pontus and Armenia are really the two that are major states all through the Hellenistic period and claim this kind of Achaemenid heritage. And in Armenia's case, kind of spawn a lot of the other little kingdoms that claim the same thing.
And yeah, I mean, the Mithridates, I think the Mithridates are probably the most famous of these Persian successor states, if we're going to use that terminology, in terms of at least a direct descendants from the Persian system that was in place before Alexander down. I think they ruled technically, even though they were client states at that point, almost to the 300s. So it's a period of well over 1,000 years. Well, not quite. So it's at least several hundreds and hundreds of years. That's a pretty impressive milestone. And a lot of it, I mean, we all know Mithridates of Pontus, or Mithridates the sixth of Pontus, the famous one, the so-called poison king. But clearly, like, there must have been something to draw on these Persian imagery, the Persian imagery. And like some, I mean, obviously there's some stereotypical ones, like Mithridates literally name drop, like you said, name drops Xerxes as one of his sons. I think even, I don't know if it's not as specifically an Antiochid name, but one, this actually kind of bled into the Seleucids. One of Antiochus's, Antiochus III, that is, one of his sons was named Mithridates. And this was actually Antiochus IV Epiphanes, but then they changed his name when he took the throne. But it was probably given as a way of his mother, who was a Pontic princess. So clearly there was a lot of this element going on even at the time, even though we don't know much about their history prior to Mithridates VI.
Yeah, I also thought what is interesting about Mithridates VI is that he doesn't just claim ancestry from the Achaemenid past. He also just claims the side of Alexander. So he just tries to have the best of both worlds. And he is descended from every royal family he can at the same time, because, well, it's convenient, you know, depending on who you're talking to, it's best to harken back to the great mythical past where the Achaemenids were still around, or Alexander. And that helps you conquer Greece, and or at least try to.
Yeah, I want to kind of talk about how specifically Mithridates VI, and then kind of, we have to assume, some of his ancestors made those connections, because they have two sort of connections that they try to make to the Achaemenids. One, they claim descendants from one of the conspirators. They don't, as far as I know, specify which in any of their genealogies, but that's partly because they also then try to take their genealogies back through the royal line, which is, you know, obviously kind of says, well, is it you're descended from the conspirators, or are you descended from the kings? And you can be both, because that is a period of 250 years of intermarrying to work with. But they either go one way or the other. They don't try to link those claims up at all.
I mean, you definitely see from what I could tell, you definitely see a lot more of this emphasis on that Persian ancestry and connections when the geopolitical environment of the Hellenistic world had changed rapidly, where the Seleucids were now either restricted to the Levant or even parts of Mesopotamia, where you have this sort of free-for-all, whereas all these powers start to claim when these bigger ones collapse. And that's when you start getting more of that prevalence of, you know, like the Pontic kings, the Armenians, I believe there's the Arontids and the Artaxids, and also the breakaway states like the Fratarraka, or Elymais is technically Elamite, but that's neither here nor there. So I'm curious, like, what, like, I want to go back and see, is there any point that they really, like, what was the perception of these Achaemenids before that point, like when we're talking about the period right after Alexander and the early stage of the Hellenistic world?
Well, a lot of them that we're talking about here, like Pontus, well, sort of Pontus, the Mithridatic family and Armenia, never really submitted. They just kind of stayed their own little kingdoms. Armenia in particular had been kind of bouncing back and forth for a while between the Orontid dynasty of satraps, which were really the Hidarnid dynasty of satraps that do have a relatively well-documented ancestry back to the conspiracy of Darius, and are also the ancestors of the Artaxad kings of Armenia. Just like they take a segue through Sophene and hop back over to the Armenian side after a couple generations. But they were loyalists. Like Armenia in particular, the last satrap Orontes was with Darius III in Ecbatana before he fled east. And the only reason he didn't go was because he still had to defend his territory because Alexander never got there.
Yeah, you also mentioned before the Fratarakas, and I think those are an interesting study also because it depends a lot on which theory you subscribe to. I subscribe to them appearing later versus earlier, but that's neither here nor there. But essentially in Persia, we had this dynasty of religious / temporal leaders depending on the time period. And they essentially took up the mantle, the religious role that the Achaemenid King of Kings had at the, when the empire was still around, and they just try and carry it on. And they go through it for quite a while, essentially, depending on your opinions, they were more or less independent under the Seleucid Empire. And they continued to do their own thing for a while and keep that spirit alive. So we don't have too many sources on them, unfortunately, but it's interesting to see that there's still this Achaemenid ember that is glowing there. And they do achieve independence when the Seleucids are collapsing, but that's for like 3 years until the Parthians storm in and, keep them there for 400 years until something else happens. But it's another story.
I believe there is a coin. I mean, this part of it is, do they emphasize their connection to Persia as like sort of an appeal against, maybe they saw it as like the dominant powers? Because I think there's a Fratarakha coin that specifically shows what appears to be like a traditional hoplite or Greek imagery where it's a defeated Greek soldier slumped over his shield on one of the reverse of their coins. Now, Fratarakha chronology, I totally know, is a hot mess, but clearly there seems to be this sort of like harking back in the face of, look at this. We might have it visual. Hey,
oh, perfect.
There we go. Oh, okay. So there you go. Now he's actually literally
the first, I think, or something.
Literally a king bashing the head of a Greek, not unlike the Narmer palette. So there you go.
Well, and the interesting thing that you can really see with this design is this isn't a Achaemenid style king on the reverse side, because that, it's not the getup that he's actually wearing here, but it is what you would see in like the Achaemenid royal currency.
Yeah, it's interesting with the Fratarakha that they tend to always have headgear that shows them as not King of Kings. Like it starts with satrapal headgear and then it becomes slightly more glorious, but it's never, they are the King of Kings. They are the successors, essentially, at least formally. It seems like they're mostly, it seems almost like they're pretending the empire still exists and they're just satraps and they're just doing a good job. But what exists is the Seleucid Empire, which had its own connections to the, to the inheritance of the King of Kings and tried to do its own things. But Derek,
I mean, literally, like the Seleucids, they really don't. I mean, if anyone of that time period after Alexander, they're the ones most primed to be the successors of the Persians, but their contributions are relative, or anything that can really piece together is very few. Doesn't mean it's non-existent. For example, I can actually pull this up here as I'm talking. There seems to be a bit of a change in imagery on some Seleucid coins where, let me just actually go ahead and share it here. Why don't we do that? There is something we call like the Seleucids is an ancestor or a primary dynast, let's see, share screen. There we go. Hey. So for most Macedonian kings, they tend to view themselves as the chief priest of Zeus, but the Seleucids chose Apollo as their patron deity around the early part of their dynasty's reign. And on their coinage, we can compare that with Persian coinage with that of Seleucid. So in the Iranian tradition, the king is the warrior archer is super relevant and super important. And when we look at the Seleucid, we actually see now Apollo wielding the bow and the bow and the arrow. Of course, there's this part of his imagery in general in the Greek world, along with seated on the Omphalos, the world stone, or the navel of the world in the Delphi. But it probably is some sort of connection. It has a nice benefit of working with traditional Iranian archetypes and imagery. I mean, if you look at the map here on the right, I mean, it's an absolutely massive area, and the Iranian heartland forms quite a bit of it. So clearly they would try to appeal to them in some capacity. And even like they said, like earlier, like the titulature, Antiochus III was the first of the Hellenistic rulers, and I think even Greek and Roman rulers, to take the title of the Great or Megas. But at the time, he is known as Basileios Megas, Great King. I mean, that's literally a one-to-one between Persia and the Persian Great King and that of his own title, which kind of got morphed into the King of Asia, the Great, and that's how we generally know it.
Yeah, I also think it's interesting showing this tetradrachm of Antiochus IV that Antiochus was struggling-ish to try and retake Iran. So I think it's also a nice symbolic connection that the coins he's paying these soldiers with to try and retake Iran have this symbology on them.
Yeah, the titles are a good thing to note, because that's something I noticed recurring over a lot of these little dynasties, especially Commagene with Antiochus I there, claiming descent from, once again, Artaxerxes II. They would always adopt one or both of the main Achaemenid titles, King of Kings or Great King. And once the Parthians came around and started using the same titulature, there's a formal hierarchy that develops between all of these groups claiming Persian heritage, where Great King supersedes King of Kings. So the Parthians let their vassals claim to be the King of Kings so long as they don't use the Great King title, which is an interesting kind of reverse of what you'd expect and way to kind of reconcile the memory of the old system.
Yeah, I think the Indo-Parthians have the title of King of Kings, and they are still technically vassals to the people back in Ctesiphon, but practically it's more of a question. Like talking about taking the title of King of Kings from the Parthians, we can look at, for example, Armenia, where Tigranes the Great is basically installed as a puppet king by Mithridates II of Parthia. And Mithridates II did call himself King of Kings, but then when he dies, it's Tigranes who takes this title and not his own descendants. So we have this basically this interregnum between, I think, Mithridates II and Phraates III, where the Parthians don't really claim to be King of Kings, also because they're going through their own civil wars and everything. But the mantle is briefly taken over by Armenia, who then sort of loses this all, of course, in the wars with the Romans, as often happens. But yeah, it's interesting to see that the title slowly shifted over. And yeah, I'm wondering if Armenia had lasted longer, if they'd been able to maybe wrest the title from the Parthians. Although geographically, you'd wonder how much legitimacy they could claim based on where they are.
I think there was a reference when there's one of the Seleucid breakaway satraps, I think his name is Timarchus. I can't remember what text it was, but they do dismissively call him. I mean, Timarchus, I believe, was in Eastern Mesopotamia, bordering the Iranian heartland. They refer to him as the King of the Medes, which I think is really weird, considering they don't really call anybody else that. Like even the Seleucids aren't referred to as, the King of the Medes or anything comparatively. Is there cases where it's used? I mean, how many times is it used negatively by maybe the non-Greeks as like, how did that work negatively against the Greeks and Romans against these other states that maybe are more positively inclined towards the Persians?
Which king was that, Derek?
I believe that was Timarchus, who was a breakaway satrap. He was about, it was during the, I think it was after the
maybe reign. Maybe Nesropatene? I guess.
Timarchus, his coinage was almost identical to Eucratides, so he was in the same time period, which is not helpful. But
wasn't Timarchus maybe in Parthia?
I believe he might have
breakaway satrap.
Yes. I believe he was.
Yes.
That's what I was just double checking. This what I've got is calling him king of Syria, but I think that just means the Seleucid Empire. Mm-hmm. The neat thing about the Parthians and being called king of the Medes is that there's a really strong historical linguistic argument that the Parthian language is just the middle era equivalent to Median. So if the Caymanid cuneiform is Old Persian, then Parthian is middle Median.
It's fun to see that the Median Empire resurfaces after a while, basically, in that sense. But yeah, it's interesting how the Parthians sort of just make their way in from the steppe and then find out their more Iranian identity by mixing up, you know, after taking over Timarchus and Parthia.
Yeah, the other connection there that I like to point out is that the name Phraates, which is a really common Parthian name, is just a variation of Phraortes,
yeah,
which was one of the main Median kings and the main Median rebel against the Achaemenids. So there's some sort of direct connection in there.
Yeah, I mean, I guess it's sort of like how Artaxerxes becomes Ardashir.
Yeah, exactly.
And it's just in the other direction.
I think one of the weird ones, I mean, that the memory of these states in the ancient Near East and beyond Mesopotamia are pretty long. I know that in Babylonian chronicles, they actually refer to around the time of Antiochus the 6th and 7th to the resurgence of the Elamite foe. And that's probably referring to the Parthians and the Elamites. So they're kind of conflating, and they're also indirectly conflating with the Persians, whom they did not like, not really. And they harken back repeatedly to Nebuchadnezzar and this whole image. So I'm curious, like it's that whole area is a complete mess. I'm dreading looking more into it because it really is shocking of how many of these successor states like Safin, Gordine, Abedin, or Adiabene, and all these others are actually trying to assert themselves in this, what is essentially the breakdown of the entire political structure of most of West Asia.
Yeah, one of the things I was very shocked about when I was first researching it that I didn't know is that when the Seleucid Empire collapses in the East, it really collapses quite intensely. And it's not clear that the Parthians are going to be the ones that win. You know, for a long period of time, the kingdom of Karakhine in lower Mesopotamia tends to, you know, retake Babylon from time to time. So it's really a free-for-all where everybody's just trying to get this title. And in the end, it is when, you know, there are two Parthians, Mithridates the first and second, who just basically resurrect the title of King of Kings after, you know, proving that they are the ones that own Iran. And that's how it ends. And I also find that it's interesting how the title is somewhat devalued once it becomes clear that Parthia has won, essentially, and has become the new hegemon of the area, because it stops being, you know, a sign of your achievement, sort of like saying, I am the great. And it becomes more of a sign of legitimacy in the Parthian Empire, and that it shows that, you know, I am claiming to be the legitimate king. I'm not claiming to have achieved anything special. I'm just claiming that this is my proper title and this is how it should be addressed.
I do like in Bactria, Eucratides' coin doesn't say the great, but it says greatest of all kings, which is a nice, which maybe a way to mitigate that of Antiochus or of the Parthians. So, I mean, that's a pretty good delineation between the king of kings and the greatest of all kings.
Yeah, that's good. That's close to the king of the universe that Cyrus was going on.
Oh, yeah.
Believe it or not, language learning doesn't have to be difficult. You can learn naturally and speak confidently. Rosetta Stone helps you absorb a language the same way you learned your first one, through real-world context and conversation, not memorization. Practical skills you can use right away. The no memorization thing is a big plus to me. I've never been the type of person to pick up language through flipping over flashcards. It Rosetta Stone is the trusted language expert with 30 years of experience, millions of users, and 25 languages offered as the go-to language learning solution. There's no English translations. You just learn to speak, listen, and think in the language you're trying to learn. It's a more intuitive learning process, starting with words, building to phrases, and progressing to sentences. Plus, if you're like me and you're trying to learn a language that uses sounds you're not used to, the built-in True Accent speech recognition feature provides real-time feedback to help you improve those pronunciations. You can also learn anytime and anywhere with a mobile app or on your desktop. And of course, as always, it is an incredible value. You can learn for life with a lifetime membership that gives you access to all 25 languages, so you can learn as many as you want, whenever you want. Don't wait. Unlock your language learning potential now. History of Persia listeners can grab Rosetta Stone's lifetime membership for 50% off. That's unlimited access to 25 language courses for life. Visit rosettastone.com/today to get started and claim your 50% off today. Don't miss out. Go to rosettastone.com/today and start learning today.
Well, I've hopped back on to ask you some questions. We're about 15 minutes from being done. So I'm going to start with Asha's question. Asha asked, is this emphasis on claiming Persian ancestry and the Middle Eastern version of every European kingdom trying to claim successor status to Rome?
You're muted.
Yeah, we've lost you, Trevor.
I can't hear you for some reason.
Better now?
Yeah. Yes.
Okay, so I'd say it's kind of yes, kind of no, in that it really depends on who makes up the ruling class of whichever little kingdom we're talking about. The ones that had a more Hellenized Greek bent to them didn't really do this, but they tried to all link themselves back to Alexander one way or the other. Whereas the ones that were either in Iran or had maintained Iranian rule through the entire period were the ones trying to link back to Achaemenid heritage.
Yeah, I feel like in the comparison to Rome, it's not such a holy grail where, like, in Western Europe, you have, like, there is the successor to the Roman Empire and two, if you want to look at it that way. But it's not like France claims to be the legitimate successor of the Roman Empire, while, you know, in Iran, there was somewhat of a claim to that, but it was, you know, it was much more fluid. It wasn't, I think, so much the kingdom itself as the ruler that was a successor.
And honestly, go ahead, Derek.
Oh, I was going to say, just to kind of add to that point, I mean, when you look at, like, famously, we talked about Mithridates VI, it's worth noting that he was claiming the best of both Greece or Persia and or the Persians and the Greeks, in the context that the Romans were this third party away from everybody, thinking, oh, well, I am the last defender of both traditions against this incoming barbarian force. So let's hype it up both ways. And a lot of, like, as it has been said already, like, that legitimacy, and it depends on the kings and also the cultural context of who's dominating, because it does seem to wax and wane depending on how strong the Hellenistic influence is, or Hellenic, versus that of, like, central Iran or even further beyond. It's entirely debatable, entirely based on the situation.
Yeah, what I was going to add is just that this also seems to be a really Western phenomenon. Like, that's partly due to just the lack of sources in the East, but you have Armenia and Cappadocia and Pontus all in the Northwest, close to Greece, trying to claim this distinct Persian legacy. We don't hear about that from, like, Media, Tropatine, or even, like, the Fratarakas in Persia. They are using Achaemenid imagery because it's familiar, but they're really consciously avoiding, like, the dynastic names. You don't have a ton of Artaxerxes and Darius and Cyrus in there.
So speaking of Rome and Greek influence and Hellenistic influence here, one of the reasons we wanted to have this panel at Intelligent Speech was to have something that was ancient history that wasn't specifically focused on Rome or on Greece, because we know that these are very overrepresented, particularly in Western historical anything, Western historical shows, Western historical podcasts, anything of that nature. Do you feel like there's anything that overlooking of the rest of ancient history is anything that's being lost to the Western perspective by not spending the extra time looking at Persia or places like it?
I have an answer, but I'll let my two other experts talk more about that because they have their own opinions on this.
I'm sure we all kind of come down somewhere around, well, yes, definitely. That's why we're doing these shows.
Sure.
I think it's important. Like for example, we focus a lot on the ancient Greeks, classical Greece, Athens, you know. I think that when you remove the time dedicated to something like Achaemenid Persia, you lose a lot of the context of that particular place you're studying. So, I mean, you can focus on Greece and that's your little nebulous, but how do you reframe the Greco-Persian wars if you don't understand the Persians? I mean, it mm-hmm. seems like, you know, very, you know, pro-Herodotean or Plutarch. It's if you put in the greater context, like another perspective you could have on the Greco-Persian wars, it's, oh, the great king of Persia punished this little province of Europe and then left. And that's kind of it. Right. I think you need to add a lot more context towards these are important events for a different reason. But I think just appreciating the broader sense is probably the most valuable aspect.
Yeah, I agree with that in general. But yeah, the idea is that you lose a lot of the important context saying, you know, how did we get to the bit to the, you know, situation where Rome is in a death match with Persia or whatever mm-hmm. Parthia for 1,000 years. That didn't just happen because there was a whole world that existed before that. There's the whole Seleucid Empire that's slowly collapsing. And if you understand why that happened or, you know, where they're coming from, then it makes it a lot more interesting. And you see that despite maybe the map not moving very much, a lot of very interesting and important things are happening under the hood. Like culturally, you have this whole mixture between the, you know, Iranian world and a Hellenistic world that then goes back to being more Iranian in reaction to the Romans. And it's all, mm-hmm. an element that's very interesting to look into.
Right. Asha asks, were there more guys named Mithridates or cities named Alexandria?
Alexandria's all the way.
Yeah.
No, here's the thing. Asha, you've got to understand, I did an episode where I had to start cutting out paragraphs to avoid getting myself confused on Mithridates's and Mithrabarzaneses and Mithrabuzaneses. They're all different names that mean different things. But there's so many guys named Mithridates just in the 4th century, let alone an entire dynasty of kings after them.
Yeah, let me double check because I have from Alexander to I have from who's who in the age of Alexander and successors. I'm curious to see how many Mithridates pop up. LMNOP.
It's like 6 in Pontus, at least 3 in Parthia. We can just slowly build it up. Don't know about the smaller states, but hey.
Surely at there's an index where you can just go 1, 2, 3.
And yeah, I would actually in that sense, when you realistically say, like, you know, what is Alexandria versus what is just a city that was founded by Alexander, it can be a little bit different.
I know there's at least 20 Alexandrias. So that's a starting point.
Oh boy, I have, let's see, in Alexander's lifetime, Mithridates, son-in-law of Darius III, Mithridates II, Mithridates III, and Mithrabios, Mithrabuzanes, Mithrapastes, and that kind of ends that. So, and that's only for a period of about, you know, 25 years, so God only knows.
Very hardcore.
So similarly on that note, aside from the obvious language barrier and accessibility barrier of anything that has to do with antiquity, what's the most challenging thing about studying Persia?
Chronology.
Okay.
That would be mine. Thankfully, a lot of these resources are becoming more available online, Encyclopedia Iranica being one of them, and the English translations are becoming more frequent. But I mean, we have so Parthian history, various successor states of the Seleucids in the East. We're basically relying on coins, and that is either your worst nightmare or your best dream, because if you like coins and it's up your alley, if not, you just got to look at coins and be like, yeah, I just accept this hypothetical arrangement. Sure, let's go from there.
Helps you so much.
Yeah, I'd also add, you know, the massive lack of sources, modern and ancient, in having to do with Parthia specifically. Like in Parthia, I tried, when I was starting my research, I tried to look for a nice book that gave you a detailed history of everything. And the last one was published in 1938. And there's nothing else. And it's terrifying because you just need to hold on to this almost century old research and, you know, look around for papers that have updated what's going on, because otherwise you're just flailing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, those two, and I am fortunate I haven't had to fight with chronology yet, because the Achaemenids and Greeks were right up against each other so often. But there's a great website called ParthianSources.com that a professor called Jake Nabel maintains. And he has a database here of all of the surviving Parthian texts.
Wow.
There are 3, 6, 8 of them. There are 8 inscriptions and meaning, you know, papyri that aren't just like so and so sold a goat. And most of them are less than 5 lines long. Like, there's no sources for that period coming from within their own territory.
Mm.
Yeah, I got very excited when I went to the Louvre and I saw the excerpt of a letter from Artabanus III, and I thought this was amazing. I finally a Parthian document. This is so cool. And nobody else knew why I was so excited.
And one of these 8 Parthian sources is a Latin text marking the grave in Rome of 2 Arsacid hostages. So it's not even from the Empire.
Great
It's Latin in Rome. It's just about some Parthian guys.
Excellent. So really challenging then in terms of access and in genuine access, not people writing about them, but from internal within the culture. So we have about 4 minutes left. So if you guys have any final statements to make, we don't have any more questions. So this would be a great time to share your final thoughts for today on this roundtable.
I have 2. One is just like, for listeners who are interested by this stuff, we didn't even get into the religious heritage that comes out of this. There's a lot of interesting synchronism or revival of Zoroastrianism or pseudo-Zoroastrianism in a lot of these kingdoms that we could have spent just as much time talking about. And the other thing I want to do is just plug for another podcast. It's called The Legacies of Ancient Persia. It's produced by the Portavood Center from UCLA and hosted by Lexi Henning, who does the Ozymandias Project, if you've listened to that. And it's a great thing that's trying to promote academics and popular studies and, you know, what is the lesson we can learn from Iranian studies today. And they just launched that a couple weeks ago, and I figured worth giving them a shout out here.
Yeah, fantastic. Derek or Umberto, any final thoughts?
I mean, if you're looking for resources like this, I mean, the podcast is great news to find out. I mean, don't be surprised when you try to do research on these that you're going to come to a lot of dead ends, and a lot of this wrapped, as was mentioned by Umberto. Finding any sort of modern text on these things is just an absolute nightmare. I think a recent book came out, but that was translated from a German text a couple of years ago. That's the most recent update Parthian studies I know of in English. So if you honestly need help, reach out to any of us. We can probably point you in the right direction, but I wish there was more to it, but as was said, the Parthian sources are almost non-existent. So it's a lot of coins and inscriptions at most.
Yeah, definitely. So I agree also. If you need stuff, please contact us. Happy to communicate about that. And then, yeah, in general, Encyclopedia Iranica is brilliant, just to point you to interesting papers. And otherwise, do go on Google Scholar and search the name of something that's interesting, and that usually pops out something enough that's good. That's good to go.
Perfect. I think that's very helpful final thoughts. So with that, we're right about at time. We've got about 50 seconds left, so we can say thank you so much for being a part of this panel. Thank you for being a part of Intelligent Speech today. And for all of you who are watching, we'll see you at the next panel.
If you want more information about this podcast, you can go to hopfulmedia.com. That's where you'll find things like my bibliography, episode imagery, and additional resources. If you want to hear more of my voice, you can listen to America Secret Wars, where I tell my friends and guests the story of forgotten and overlooked conflicts in American history. And if you want to support my projects, you can go to hopfulmedia.com.co to donate, buy merch, or subscribe to get access to ad-free listening and bonus content. If you don't want to spend money on me, that's absolutely fine. The best ways to support a project like this are to share on social media or leave reviews on your podcast app of choice. So review on Apple, rate on Spotify, and you can find me on Blue Sky at History of Persia and on Instagram at History of Persia Podcast. Until next time, thank you all so much for listening to The History of Persia.
This isn't just a game, it's a once-in-a-generation event. The Harlem Globetrotters 100-year tour. Celebrate 100 years of high-flying dunks, 100 years of show-stopping moves, and 100 years of changing the game. Bring the whole family and be part of the legacy. This game is once in a century. Be there at Schottenstein Center on December 27th. Go to harlemglobetrotters.com for your tickets to the 100-year tour.
Hey, History of Persia fans. Before Persia, another civilization controlled the Middle East, the very first civilization, the inventors of writing itself. From the clay tablets of ancient Mesopotamia come the oldest stories. The history and myth of the first Mesopotamians is the subject of the Oldest Stories podcast online at oldeststories.net. If you like ancient history, come check out the Oldest Stories after you listen to this episode.